Now, ever since President Obama took office in 2008, Americans have been stocking up on guns and ammunition. Some have coined it as the Obama effect. And in the aftermath of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, as the arms control debate in Washington heated up, sales have gone through the roof. And now there's an ammo shortage. Here's Marianne McCune of WNYC and Planet Money.
A classic economics textbook would tell you this shouldn't happen.
I've been looking for 380 ammo, and it's very hard to get.
So how long have you been looking?
Oh, about 6 months.
Really?
Yes.
Bill Flaherty and gun owners across the country say it's also hard to find ammo for some rifles, for the popular 9mm. Even 22 rounds, the small ones, have been hard to come by. Flaherty is here buying what he can from the owner of a bustling gun shop in southern New Jersey.
I'm Bob Vyden, Bob's Little Sports Shop.
In back, there's a pistol range. Bob Vyden has had this operation for almost 50 years, and he's doing more volume than ever. Old customers are stocking up, new customers are pouring in.
They're afraid of their government.
They think Washington is going to take away their rights.
They want to be protected in case something happens, they can't get it in the future.
And some ammo dealers, they are doing what the invisible hand of the market would direct them to. Demand is high, supply isn't keeping up, so raise the price.
Like some places, especially online, they're charging twice as much.
Customer Michael Deary says Bob's Little Sports Shop could charge more, too.
Would you be mad or would you be willing to pay a little bit more?
I would pay a little bit more.
Like how much more?
I'd probably pay twice as much what it's worth.
So we're in a store where they can't keep enough product on the shelves. We've got customers saying they'll pay twice the price for the product. And still, the owner says, no thanks.
Bob, Mikey says that he would pay probably twice as much for the ammo that he wants to buy. What do you say to that?
We don't want to do that. We want to keep customers coming back because we want to be fair.
Apparently, so do some of the best-known ammo sources across the country. At the sporting goods store Cabela's and at Walmart, shelves are empty, but prices are fairly consistent. During my conversations at Bob's Little Sports Shop, the word fair came up about 24 times. And that word is key here.
Traditional economic theory doesn't really have room for fairness perceptions.
Margaret Campbell is a professor of marketing at University of Colorado's Business School. And she says about 30 years ago,
people started noticing that there were these kind of quirks, according to traditional economic theory.
For example, the reason behind a price increase matters to people.
If a consumer sees a price go up in an unexpected fashion, then they want to know why. Why has that gone up?
Campbell says there are a lot of reasons consumers approve of, but an increase in demand, that is not one of them. Raising your prices just because all of a sudden more people want your stuff, customers don't like it, and a lot of retailers try to avoid it, even if it means inconveniencing their customers in other ways.
I'll take a box of that.
Back at Bob's Little Sports Shop and a lot of other places, they are rationing. And customer Michael Deary says that is fair.
Let everybody get a little bit instead of somebody getting all of it.
Of course, the invisible hand always finds some way. Some people have been buying ammo at low cost and selling it at a higher price online. Essentially, scalping bullets. Scalpers don't care about return customers, and their customers don't expect them to be fair. Marianne McCune, NPR News, New York.
What you're hearing here is a new spin on very traditional American folk music.
Are there anybody here like Mary? We've been called to my Jesus and he'll draw nigh.
That's Sam Amidon singing Weeping Mary, originally an old shape note hymn from the mid-1800s. Shape note singing is an American a cappella choral tradition with roots that date back to colonial times.
It was basically farmers and tavern keepers, you know, normal people, writing four-part choral songs without having had any musical training. You know, it's these crazy harmonies and really boisterous, intense songs.
To give an idea how that music originally sounded, here is a traditional take of Weeping Mary.
Are there anybody here like Mary a-weeping? Call to my Jesus and he'll draw nigh.
That recording actually features Sam Amidon's parents singing with the word-of-mouth chorus. It's the kind of music he was surrounded by while growing up in Vermont.
These are some of the melodies that are the deepest seated for me. That was the world I was born into. And in terms of the shape note music being a social tradition, it was something that happened, yeah, once a month in our town. You know, it would move to different people's houses, sometimes ours. It was a potluck on a Saturday afternoon.
So he was a part of this folk tradition. And now, in a new album, Sam Amidon reimagines the same song that his parents sang.
Glory, 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 glory be to my God.
Amidon says he takes an old tune that gets stuck in his head and ends up adding something new.
I often am playing the guitar and I'll write a guitar part that's totally just on its own, and then I'll realize that some melody that has been bonking around in there in my brain, you know, will fit over this of what I've written on the guitar.
Another melody bonking around in his brain is a tune by 1920s banjo player Doc Boggs.
In the horizon is south in peace and content. The days of my boyhood are scarcely half spent.
That's the song Bright Sunny South, a Civil War era song about a young soldier leaving home to go fight. It ended up being the title track of Sam Amidon's new album.
I knew this song for a long time, but it wasn't until the last couple of years that I really started to sing it. And for my version, I was playing those two chords in the guitar. That song came back out, and I'm sure it did for a reason.
In the bright sunny south, in peace and content, these days of my boyhood I scarcely have spent.
Sam Amidon's new album, Bright Sunny South, is out this week, and you can watch a music video at nprmusic.org.
Ever dear to my memory, sweeter is my dream.
You're almost through the week. It's Friday. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. This week in San Francisco, Google held its annual Developers Conference. The internet search giant debuted updates for just about everything from Google Plus to Gmail to Maps and gave talks on gadgets like Google Glass. And as NPR Steve Henn reports, Google laid out its vision for its future, as well as our future.
Google's annual Developers Conference is probably the best chance to get a sense of where this giant company is headed. When Amit Singhal, who runs Google Search, walked out on stage, there was a big blank screen above his head with four tiny words. The end of search.
Yes.
The audience in the vast Moscone Center Hall fell completely silent.
It's a provocative title, indeed, especially coming from Google. But I believe with good reason.
Today, Amit Singhal says Google is rolling out new ways to search, including one where you can just talk to your computer.
Amit was talking about hot wording.
Johanna Wright is vice president of product management at Google.
So no hands. Okay, Google, show me things to do in Santa Cruz.
Here are popular attractions in Santa Cruz.
But simply talking to a computer to search is just the beginning.
Okay, Google. How far is it from here?
The drive from your location to Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk is 73.9 miles.
Think about what Wright actually said. How far is it from here? Google could answer that question because Google knew where Wright was standing, and it put her question in the context of her previous search. Google knew it, in this case, was Santa Cruz. And if she goes to Santa Cruz and is standing on the boardwalk and asks,
how tall do you have to be to ride the Giant Dipper?
Google will know Wright is talking about a roller coaster. Again and again this week, Google showed off products that were possible because this company is now collecting information about us in all sorts of ways. No longer is a search query simply made up of a string of words. Now, in many ways, your location, your past behavior, your history, your interactions with other people are all part of one constant ongoing search, a search to reach you with new useful information or ads at key moments. Take Google Maps.
Wouldn't it be awesome if you could build billions of maps, one for every user?
Bernie Seefeld at Google says Google's new maps will adapt to you individually. His Google map of San Francisco will highlight his favorite restaurant, Francis. Mine would look different. And his map will offer personalized recommendations.
Like Bar Tartine shows up because it's similar to Francis, and I like Francis, so it's a recommendation for me.
Whether you find this kind of thing creepy or cool, there's an enormous amount of technical wizardry behind all of this. Brian McLind at Google says the company's constantly piecing together bits of information to gain new insights.
This idea of generating data from other data is fundamental to what Google does.
And Google is using similar computer science techniques to create even more detailed, nuanced pictures of us, its users. For example, Google Plus now offers a service where Google will organize your vacation photos for free, automatically picking out the best shots. Vic Gundatra, who runs Google Plus, says the service recognizes important landmarks, whether or not people are smiling, and even...
Who's important to you? Who's in your family circle? And we apply appropriate social boosts so that your wife and your children are in the highlights.
To do that, Google has to run facial recognition on your photos, try to identify who you're traveling with, who your friends are, who you're closest to. And in the process, those photos become another piece of data for Google to mine. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
As regular listeners to this program know, Google data mining activities raise privacy concerns for many people, and so does one of the company's most talked about new products, Google Glass. Is getting attention from Capitol Hill. Eight members of Congress are asking the company how it plans to protect people's privacy once Google customers are walking around with little cameras mounted beside their eyes on the equivalent of eyeglass frames. In a letter mailed yesterday, the lawmakers asked Google what it would do to prevent Google Glass from unintentionally collecting data about Google Glass users as well as the people who come into the camera's view without their consent. The company declined to comment, but has previously said that data gathered by the new device will be handled in accordance with existing privacy policies. Next week, voters in Falmouth, Massachusetts decide whether to spend $14 million to tear down two wind turbines, or turbines if you prefer. The Cape Cod town installed these turbines just 3 years ago in an effort to produce renewable energy and cut costs. Nearby residents say the turbines are a health hazard and that the only cure is to take them down. Sean Corcoran of member station WCAI has more.
With two 400-foot-tall turbines slowly spinning in the background, Rob Laird talks about climate change and how he first thought the machines would be part of the solution.
This is great. This is going to solve lots of problems. And, you know, look, it's right in my backyard, which is, you know, that's kind of neat because it's this new cool thing coming along. And then they turned it on and... It wasn't 20 minutes after it was turned on when I called Town Hall and, like, this thing's really loud.
Laird lives about 1,300 feet from the closest turbine, which helps power the town's wastewater treatment plant. Since it began spinning in spring 2010, some 40 neighborhood households have complained about things such as headaches, vertigo, and sleep interruption, which is what Laird experiences.
We've got to come up with alternate power sources and stop burning fossil fuels. There's no question about it. I'm not sure that putting a wind turbine, if you can't make a neighborhood uninhabitable. I think that's the problem. That's what this has done, in effect.
Falmouth was among the first towns in Massachusetts to install large turbines so close to homes. When people complained, the town tried curtailing their operation when it got real windy. Then they shut them off at night. They even considered buying out the homeowners. But now, Board of Selectmen Chairman Kevin Murphy says the turbines simply need to come down.
It was a mistake. It wasn't the right project. It wasn't the right location.
Initially, complaints about health impacts were met with skepticism, and for 3 years, the turbine issue festered. Today, there are bumper stickers and lawn signs reading, "Heal Our Town," and many residents who don't even live near the turbine say they have to go.
These folks living up on Blacksmith Shop Road, they are not NIMBYs, whiners, or liars.
That's Rob Mastriani. He doesn't live near the turbines, but as a taxpayer, he would have to pay for their removal. Selectmen say taking down and paying off the debt will cost the typical Falmouth household about $800 over 20 years. Mastriani says he'll pay it.
If my taxes go up a little bit, that's a small price to pay.
Not for resident Joe Hackler. Amidst a chorus of weed whackers and clucking chickens, he questions the legitimacy of the noise complaints.
That noise you hear in the background is a lot louder than those machines ever are.
But neighbors typically don't object to the whoosh, whoosh sound of the turbines. Rather, they talk about something called infrasound, a low-frequency sound that's controversial and not well understood. Selectman Doug Jones explains it as a vibration or sound pressure that gets reflected off the turbine itself and towards the homes.
It's not something you hear, but that's the thing that they say, it just makes them feel sick. And that's the one we don't have tons of scientific evidence to really affirm.
Complaints about wind farms appear to be increasing in some parts of New England, where things already are crowded and turbines are being installed closer to homes. Andy Bridges is with the Mass Clean Energy Center, which works with Massachusetts to develop wind projects. He says the wind industry and its advocates are reacting to complaints.
The wind industry is paying attention to the complaints people have had and are re-examining their siting strategies and decisions based on those complaints. And I think they're very focused on developing projects that will be ultimately well-received by the community, which serves everybody's interest better.
Voters in Falmouth go to the polls on Tuesday to decide whether the turbines here should come down. For NPR News, I'm Sean Corcoran.
Here's a pattern we've seen in several countries in recent years. An authoritarian regime is pushed aside in the name of democracy. But sometimes with democracy comes ethnic and sectarian tensions. The latest example of this is in Myanmar, also known as Burma, where Buddhist nationalism is on the rise. NPR's Anthony Kuhn this morning profiles a Burmese monk, who was accused of being the spiritual leader behind a wave of nationalism and anti-Muslim sentiment.
In March, more than 40 people were killed in fighting between Buddhists and Muslims in the central Burmese town of Maitila. From amateur videos on the internet like this one, it's clear that some Buddhist monks joined in the violence. Some monks were victims of the fighting, others tried to stop it. But some people say that one monk in particular was behind it. He's the abbot of this monastery in Myanmar's second city, Mandalay. 45-year-old U Wiratu is considered a talented scholar of Buddhist scriptures in the ancient Pali language, and that gives him authority among Buddhists. He's dressed in saffron-colored robes. Wiratu says he was in Maitila during the violence and was trying to stop it.
We spoke to the crowds to try to control the situation. We assured them of their safety. We told them we intended to protect their lives and homes and asked them to join us.
Wiratu admits he's a Buddhist nationalist, but he says he's just defending his nation and his religion.
The Burmese race has been insulted. The Buddhist religion has been attacked, and our country has been trespassed. These are the origins of our nationalism.
Wiratu says that the recent violence in Maitila is the result of fighting between Muslims and Buddhists last year in western Rakhine State that killed more than 110 people. The group Human Rights Watch has called this ethnic cleansing against Muslims, but Wiratu says it was an organized attack on Buddhism. Wiratu says he's not anti-Muslim, he's just against Buddhists marrying and doing business with Muslims.
Muslims who live in Burma have raped Burmese girls, even mute girls, mad girls, Buddhist nuns too. They married Burmese Buddhist girls and forced them to convert to Islam by stepping on the pictures of the Buddha and pagodas. All this inflicted a lot of mental pain.
Under Britain's colonial rule of Burma, many Muslim Indians dominated professions such as medicine and moneylending. Some economic resentment from that period lingers on. Perhaps the most contradictory thing about U Wiratu is that he and his followers describe him as pro-democratic. Pictures of democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi meeting with President Obama are prominently displayed in his monastery. Matt Walton is a Burma expert at George Washington University. He says that a century ago, Buddhist nationalists like U Wiratu led the effort to make Burma into a modern democracy free of British colonial rule.
You had this really complex combination of democratic intentions, or at that time, a desire for independence, that was coupled often with this virulent exclusionary nationalism, this idea that in order to get our independence, we had to get rid of all of these other groups that weren't really part of the nation.
Walton says that in Burma, the concept of democracy often emphasizes the rule of the majority, which in this case means ethnic Burman and Buddhist. Buddhist nationalism has also cropped up in Sri Lanka, where majority Buddhists are in conflict with Hindu and Christian Tamils, and in southern Thailand, where there are tensions with Malay Muslims. A decade ago, authorities charged U Wiratu with inciting anti-Muslim riots outside Mandalay, and they jailed him for 8 years. He's aware that it could happen this time, too.
One of my followers was arrested. Another one is missing, and his house was searched. Some of the books of mine were confiscated. They are watching me, too, and probably will arrest me soon.
He points to two men who have quietly come in and sat down during our interview. One, he says, is police, and the other, military intelligence. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Investigators in Texas yesterday said they're still trying to figure out what caused the deadly explosion last month at the West Fertilizer Company. The blast killed 14 people and destroyed dozens of homes and other buildings. The chemical industry's own reports show thousands of plants across the country where a single accident or terrorist attack could put an entire community at risk, even a city. Some government officials and public advocates have been fighting for decades to require companies to redesign their plants to make them safer. But as NPR's Daniel Swerdling reports, industry executives and their allies in Congress have blocked those proposals.
You might think that everything would have changed for the chemicals industry on April 16, 1947. They call it the Texas City Disaster, the worst industrial accident in U.S. history.
Night and day, for three horrible days, the inferno that almost blasted Texas City from the map rages unchecked and uncontrollable.
A ship loaded with ammonium nitrate exploded. That's the chemical that apparently caused the disaster last month in Texas. The ship triggered more explosions at chemical facilities on shore. More than 500 died. So you might think Congress would have forced industry to redesign the way they handle chemicals.
In a little more than a square mile, explosion and fire create a holocaust that baffles description.
Or you might think everything would have changed for the chemicals industry on December 3rd, 1984.
Good evening. Tragedy in central India.
That was the Bhopal disaster caused by an American corporation. Here's ABC News.
The Union Carbide pesticide plant on the edge of town suddenly began to leak. A huge cloud of suffocating poisonous gas carried on a southerly wind.
Thousands of people died. Union Carbide paid almost $500 million in damages. Or you might think the chemical industry really had to reform in 2005. Here's NBC.
Now to Texas and the huge explosion that rocked a BP refinery yesterday. Was this an incident that could have been avoided?
At least 15 people were killed and almost 200 injured. BP says they paid $1.6 billion to compensate victims and their families. Government statistics, based on press reports, show there have been hundreds of accidents at chemical facilities that have killed people in just the past dozen years. And Christine Todd Whitman says, when she heard about the West explosion last month in Texas,
it just made me so mad, and you wanted to take Congress and shake it and say, listen, what more does it take for you to understand that we need some action here?
Whitman ran EPA under President George W. Bush.
I'm a Republican. I am leery of too much regulation. Believe me, I understand it. But there are times when you need it. There's a reason for some of this stuff.
Over the past few decades, government and industry have taken steps to make chemical plants safer. For instance, Congress passed two landmark laws after the Bhopal disaster in the 1980s. They told industry, you have to tell the public which dangerous chemicals you're using. You have to tell how many people would be at risk of getting killed or injured if there's an accident at your plant. And what are you doing to prevent it? But then came 9/11, and security specialists worried that those laws on chemical plants aren't strong enough.
I mean, these things that we are talking about, chemical plants, are really pre-positioned weapons of mass destruction.
Sam Faddis knows about weapons of mass destruction. He used to work for the CIA. Faddis realized if terrorists had attacked a chemical facility instead of the World Trade Center, they could have caused a bigger disaster. The chemical industry's own reports back then showed there were hundreds of plants across the country where a single incident could potentially kill thousands of people. For instance, the water treatment utility in Washington, D.C. reported that if their chlorine tanks ruptured, a deadly cloud could reach the U.S. Capitol.
And as long as you got the wind blowing in the right direction, I mean the right direction from the standpoint of a terrorist, that cloud is now going to drift into areas populated by literally millions of human beings.
So, some officials in the Bush administration decided there's a fundamental problem with the way the government regulates chemical plants. The laws basically tell industry, it's fine if you use huge amounts of deadly chemicals, even if you're right next to a city. Just be sure you protect them with measures like strong tanks and fences. Bob Bostock said, those aren't solutions. They're Band-Aids.
It was the only thing that kept me up at night.
Bostock was a top advisor to the head of EPA, Christine Todd Whitman. They decided that one of the best ways to make chemical facilities safer is to change the way they operate so they don't need so many dangerous chemicals in the first place. Engineers often call the approach inherently safer design.
For a lot of these chemicals, there are other chemicals that can be substituted that do not pose the same sort of effect if there was a breach.
And some companies did substitute other chemicals after 9/11. The wastewater treatment plant in Washington, D.C. got rid of deadly chlorine gas within 3 months, and they started treating water with safer methods. Bostock and Whitman drafted a law that would require companies across the country to see if they could use inherently safer design. They said, look, maybe every plant can't switch. It might be technically impossible or too expensive. But they said the government should require executives to at least try to do it.
If there was ever a successful attack on one of these facilities or even an accidental release, the first question you would get asked as a policymaker is, you knew this was a problem. Why haven't you done anything about it?
Meanwhile, back in 2002, a key Senate committee voted to support inherently safer technology unanimously. Then suddenly, everything screeched to a halt. President Bush's aide said, forget it. They didn't explain why publicly. And since then, public health groups and environmental groups and unions and Democrats and Republicans, they've all tried over and over again to get Congress to reconsider. They tried in 2003 and 2006 and 2009 and 2010. Whitman says, here we've just seen the devastation in Texas. You'd think Congress would finally act.
But they're very powerful influences, and in politics, you always sort of trace that back to the money.
And the money is coming from?
I guess the money's coming from the industry.
And you can see where some of that money flows if you log on to opensecrets.org. This website is run by the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. They track campaign finance. And the site shows that the petrochemicals industry has funded key members of Congress who've opposed inherently safer design. And take just one of many examples. Type in the name Fred Upton from Michigan. Upton is the Republican chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. No bill on inherently safer design can go far without his support. The page on Upton shows that the petrochemicals industry is one of the main industries that finance his campaign. Upton did not grant our request for an interview, but a spokesman for the chemical industry did.
You know, we stand second to none as the chemical industry in trying to implement an appropriate focus on process safety and security.
Michael Walls is vice president of the American Chemistry Council. They represent Dow, DuPont, ExxonMobil, Chevron, most of the leading petrochemical firms. The Chemistry Council has lobbied Congress for years to kill bills on inherently safer design. I asked Walls.
As a layperson who got a C in chemistry, I have to say it sounds like a really attractive and totally common sense approach. You know, get chemical facilities to do everything they can to figure out, can we switch to different chemicals?
Daniel, I'd agree with you. It does sound attractive. But the basic choice comes down to, do you mandate something like a review of inherently safer technology, or do you want to require its consideration at the right time for each particular facility? One of the questions here is, who decides? Who decides what is inherently safer in any particular case?
Wall says there are already plenty of agencies that regulate the chemicals industry, although, as the West Fertilizer Investigation suggests, they're not always paying close attention. I also talked to Kathy Mathers. She's vice president of the Fertilizer Institute. Their member companies make and sell ammonium nitrate, among other chemicals. That's the product that apparently caused the explosion last month in Texas, and it's caused some of the worst industrial accidents in history.
So it sounds like you're worried about federal regulators, somebody in some bureaucracy in Washington, making a decision that's well-intentioned but would affect the fertilizer industry and the food industry.
Well, agriculture knows agriculture. And certainly the regulators have their role in society. At this point, we have not seen a version of an inherently safer technology bill that we would support.
I was quite surprised that anybody will resist this concept of prevention.
Rafael More Erazo runs the Chemical Safety Board. That's the main federal agency that investigates accidents at chemical plants and then recommends how to prevent them.
The board is investigating the Texas fertilizer explosion right now. And More Erazo recommends a new law. He says the federal government should require every chemical company to analyze whether they can use inherently safer design to get rid of dangerous chemicals.
You have to make a cost-benefit about what is more costly, to engage in a process to try to mitigate and avoid hazards, or deal with the families of the people that get killed, the destruction of an industry, the destruction of a community. And I claim that it's a lot more expensive to deal with these catastrophic losses than what it will take to invest to prevent this to happen in the first place.
All this raises a question. Where is President Obama on this issue?
That's our $64,000 question.
That's Rick Hind. He's legislative director of Greenpeace. Greenpeace is one of the leaders of the coalition's campaign for inherently safer technology. Obama co-sponsored a bill calling for it back when he was in the Senate. His administration backed the idea again after he became president. But
we're very concerned because we've been asking for them to look into this and to do something since 2011. And they said, well, after the election, maybe we'll do something. And now we're still waiting.
We asked the White House, where does the president stand on inherently safer design? A spokesman wouldn't say, but he sent us a statement that said, quote, chemical plant safety is a high priority, unquote.
Well, right now we're standing next to the baseball field, and if you look right behind it, you can actually just touch the refinery.
That's a mother named Erin Coles. She wishes President Obama would take action. She's taken me to Paulsboro High School. That's across the New Jersey border from Philadelphia. Her kids go here. In fact, two daughters are practicing track while the baseball team plays a game. And right beyond them, there's the PBF Energy Company refinery. It looms over the baseball diamond, metal towers, plumes of white smoke.
It almost looks like Cape Canaveral, where you see the launch pads and things like that.
Coles has helped organize a community group to educate people about the potential dangers. The refinery's own reports show that it uses tons of hydrofluoric acid. They show that an accident could send a toxic cloud across an area with 3 million people.
I'm concerned that so many people live in a radius around the plant that, depending on the wind direction and which way the plume goes from the refinery, it could be fatal to them.
A recent study by the United Steelworkers concludes that the company could use inherently safer design and switch to safer chemicals. In fact, other refineries have already done that. I called PBF to find out why they don't switch, but they referred me to their industry trade group. A spokeswoman wrote that there are a wide variety of safety measures to prevent an accident at refineries like this one. Of course, that's what some executives said about other plants before they exploded. Daniel Zwerdling, NPR News.
You can read more about the debate over chemical plant safety at our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.